Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast, a book of the week format podcast in which meaning escapes the boundaries of literature, begins creeping apocalyptically into the world of long-form audio. I am Hans Berger, one of the three hosts of the Book Spider podcast. I'm here with my normal co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg. I'm just going to go in the edit and cut out that like long gap between when I announced you and when you spoke. This week, we're discussing Jeff Vandermeer's Authority, the second book in his Southern Reach trilogy. And this novel follows from the events in the first book, Annihilation, as the agency known as the Southern Reach attempts to investigate and control the mysterious region called Area X. In Authority, we discover that the psychologist from Annihilation was the director of the Southern Reach, and in her absence, our newly introduced protagonist, John Martinez, nicknamed Control, has been appointed to direct the Southern Reach thanks to the efforts of his mother. And we learn that Control is a chronic fuck-up, an incompetent spy with a history of poorly and sometimes catastrophically infiltrating domestic terrorists, someone who has basically failed upward due to family connections. We learn that the Southern Reach itself is a barely functioning and maybe even barely existent federal agency, which in its many years of investigation has learned nothing meaningful about Area X. So Control learns a bit about the specifics of Area X, particularly that it is contained by a border that eliminates everything that touches it, most viscerally illustrated by the image of 2,000 rabbits being driven against the border by riot shields, panicking as they vanish into non-existence. There's speculation that some third party has perhaps imposed this border and that Area X is seeking to escape it. Control's main source of possibly helpful information is the questioning of Ghost Bird, aka the biologist from the first book, the first-person narrator of Annihilation, although it's evident to readers of the prior text that this Ghost Bird is a doppelganger who has returned in her stead. And Control discovers evidence that the director herself was losing her grip prior to her expedition into Area X. She has an immortal plant in her desk drawer. She's covered her closet in a map of Area X, along with texts from sermons of the lighthouse keeper, Saul Evans, who we eventually learn was some sort of close relative. Although that, if you've read the third book, that's complicated a bit in the third book. The words written on the wall are the same as the words written on the wall in Annihilation by the monster known as the Crawler, who was, in fact, a mutated form of Evans. So Control discovers that he's being manipulated by hypnotic commands from his contact at Central. He discovers that that contact is Lowry, the lone survivor of the first expedition. He discovers that another Southern Reach staff member, Whitby, has gone quite mad and filled an upstairs room with a horrifying set of drawings of Area X-style monsters. Shortly after the discovery of Whitby's madness, Control discovers a soft wall where a door should be, realizes Area X has escaped its confinement, has been enveloping much of the Southern Reach, and presumably beginning the apocalyptic envelopment of the southeastern U.S. and eventually the world. In a last-ditch attempt to bypass this process, he travels to a remote coastal area to find Ghost Bird. And together, they jump into a tide pool, which transports them to Area X, setting up the beginning of the third book. Did I leave anything out of that synopsis that you guys think is important or that you want to make sure that we touch on? So, you know, sometimes I start off with this question, sometimes I don't, but how did, just in from the most basic kind of subjective response standpoint, how did you guys like this? How did you feel about it?
I really liked it. I think that I'm not talking out of turn when I say, I believe you had said that you didn't really think very much of the second and the third books in this series when you first read the series. And I actually had a similar experience. At least as I remember it, I remember being very fond of Annihilation and being kind of disappointed or frustrated with, especially this one, especially Authority. And I think I am just a different reader at this point, or maybe I'm just coming to it with, you know, more time. I don't know exactly what to point to, but I enjoyed it very much. I think that I make peace, you know, reading it now, with the fact that, like, much of the first 7/8 of the novel is sort of like layers of aimless speculation from the perspective of someone, as you said, who's sort of aware of himself as an incompetent. But there's something about it that I enjoyed this time around, and maybe we can figure that out or not while talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of that for me was expectation. Maybe I did definitely say that I was pretty underwhelmed by the second and third books the first time that I read them, and I do suspect that maybe part of that just had to do with, I mean, the first book is, to a greater or lesser extent, like people battling weird monsters in a scary, unknown place where anything can happen, right? And it's a relatively atmospheric, relatively slow version of that. But maybe partly because of my experience with the film, like, I did kind of think of this as being, you know, people, again, like battling weird monsters in a strange land. And this, you know, Authority is not that, right? It's in some sense, not much really happens until the very end. And then at the very end, if you've gone into it expecting kind of more of the violent surrealism of the first book, you really only get a little bit of that at the end. And I think if you've read it with the wrong expectation or in the wrong frame of mind or at the wrong pace, I do think that it can come across as anticlimax, right? But having gone into it now, remembering the basic narrative structure of it and the pace and the fact that, you know, like I said in one of my questions, I think most of the important events have happened before the novel starts. Going into it with all that understanding, yeah, I actually really enjoyed kind of sitting in the atmosphere of it. Patrick, what did you think?
I thought it was great. I thought it was hilarious. Satirical. I liked that the main character was a fuck up. Like, that was what was interesting to me, and that was what made me, like, if he wasn't a fuck up, if he was competent at being a spy and being part of a pretty nasty government agency, you know, it'd be very difficult to kind of, well, assuming that, like, that change also makes it less satirical, you know, I think it would be hard to get into, but, I thought getting into his psyche, learning, like, you know, about his past experience as a spy, like getting into the depths of how he's being manipulated. It was all very interesting. And like control, that's a reference to Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
A famously lost episode of this podcast, if I remember right.
Is that a lost episode? We didn't.
I think it's a lost episode. Yeah, I can't remember who had the technical issues, but it was a surprisingly slow, difficult, unfun book, which we then lost our discussion of.
Oh.
But anyway.
But it
is still good to pinpoint that reference.
Right. Which I thought was, you know, like, I liked the way it was referenced, and that reference was enough for me to understand that we were getting a different book. Like, the very fact that it starts off with Control, like, you know, understanding that this character's name is Control, I'm like, oh, okay, so we're kind of getting, like, more of, like, an espionage-type story where Area X is the focal point, but not the setting. Like, that really kind of clued me in. Thought it was great. Thought it was really enjoyable. I'm looking forward to reading the third one.
And not just an espionage story, I suppose, but an espionage story that is slower and murkier and less conventionally exciting than you might think going into it, right?
Yeah, but somehow less opaque than Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Yeah, I would agree, actually. Somehow less opaque than Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. But compelling in a different way for the sake of its opacity in both cases.
As I've called myself an anarchist before and someone, you know, and maybe now, maybe I would think of myself as more of like anarchist adjacent or whatever. But either way, someone who feels very critical of state power and state power structures, you know, this was a very satisfying read.
I like the point that you made about his incompetence as a spy being part of what makes him appealing as a protagonist, right? Because one of the things that I was thinking about, one of the questions I had asked was like, how invested can we be in a character who, in a lot of ways, I mean, has certain qualities we would regard as despicable, right? In addition to like working for the apparatus of government power, he's also someone who has been sheltered by family connection. And your point, I think, is really interesting that paradoxically, the fact that he's bad at all that actually makes him much more appealing than if he were good at that, right? If he were a good spy who had made competent use of family connection to rise within the government, it would be very hard not to regard him as a loathsome figure, but his incompetence actually becomes a kind of shield from the loathsomeness of his status and position. I think also his self-awareness too, right? Like his self-awareness fundamentally of himself as an incompetent fuck-up who's failed upward through family connection. Like he's remarkably frank, at least with himself about that, if not the people around him, and even the people around him to some extent, and that is appealing as well.
I'll just add to, actually another part of that is that like his mind is always working, and it's not in a winky kind of, we're not invited into a space, sort of a dramatic space outside of him very often to like laugh at him. In fact, the thing that kind of came to mind was Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks. But in Twin Peaks, Agent Cooper's sort of like bizarre like intuition works, but it's like you took that same bizarre intuition and you plugged it into the circus apparatus of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and you have control wondering if the swatted mosquito in his car is a sign that, not just a sign that someone is spying on him, but a message that person sending to him that he's under surveillance. Or, you know, there's this incredible furtiveness of mind in control that's always working and kind of sincere. That's really impossible to hate him, you know, like he seems to be trying really hard, and he's not stupid. He's just not good at this job in this system. And, you know, your point is really good, Patrick. The system is disgusting and broken. And the fact that he's, you know, like, not good at it kind of absolves him a little bit.
And his not goodness, I think, also absolves a little bit of his passivity as a protagonist, right? Because the further that we get into it, the more we understand that he's kind of been put in place as a mechanism to gather information in ways that don't actually require him to be competent. And the fact of his, even though he doesn't really crack, you know, the nature of Area X or do much of anything to solve it, the fact that he cracks the secret of his own manipulation and pushes back against it is to some extent like an act of competence and a way in which she does become an active character. And that's, you know, satisfying, I think, maybe more so than I'd appreciated on a first read. I want to touch back a little bit on, I don't know if there's too much more to say about this really, but you mentioned the ways that this is, I think it's fair to say, a novel that's critical of government authority, or, you know, it portrays control and government authority in a fairly negative light, I think, right? Do you have any sense of whether, well, I was going to just ask, what does this say about control and authority, the nature of those things? If that's too broad a question, I can narrow it down. But did you have any, relative to your own kind of philosophical perspectives on those things, did you have other thoughts about how they're being portrayed here?
Well, certainly the whole apparatus, not just control himself, the whole apparatus is incompetent. You know, they've been at this 30 years, and they haven't, you know, they haven't discovered anything. You know, they've done experiments with rabbits, you know, and, you know, gotten all the rabbits killed. They have done experiments with a variety of teams that they've sent into the area, and all of them have been devastated in one way or another. So, you know, at the very least, it portrays government entities as deeply, deeply incompetent. And malevolently so, right? Not just that they're incompetent, but that they have a central core of, you know, indecency that, you know, wreaks havoc in the lives of people affected by those systems. Now, whether that is a left or right political statement, I don't know. I have no idea about that. You know, there are people on the left and the right who think government is incompetent. They just think that it's incompetent in different ways for different reasons.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know that, I think it goes pretty far out of its way to avoid anything that I would, well, I was going to say it goes out of its way to avoid anything that could be called a political critique or a reflection on any particular political figure. I mean, I think that I don't think it has to go too far out of its way, actually. Like, to say that it's like stretching to avoid that is silly, but it, I mean, I think it doesn't easily map onto a left-right political critique. And, you know, I mean, with all these novels, the ecological themes are clear-cut enough, I think, that you certainly couldn't map a right-wing or a libertarian political critique onto it, because, you know, Vandermeer, here and in his other work, like, Vandermeer is very, very concerned about the environment. He's a very environmentally focused author. And I don't, I mean, I haven't read a bunch of interviews with him. Maybe he does in fact have these positions I'm saying he can't have. But it's very hard to imagine based on, you know, having read most of his fiction.
Right. And like thinking about Bourne, where the central corruption of the environment in that novel is done by like a giant company that like is researching biotech, stuff like that. You know, that seems, that might point more towards like a left-leaning type of view, whereas in this novel we're not quite so sure. So you know, it's up for debate.
I mean, I think you can read, well, it's not too doesn't require a great deal of perceptiveness to say that, you know, this book is critical of government authority and Bourne is critical of large capitalist corporations, and, you know, Vandermeer seems instinctively opposed to both public and private authority. I mean, that's a very, very surface level reading. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to claim any credit for saying that. But I don't know. I don't know if you'd call that. I don't think that there's any evidence to like map that carefully onto, you know, anarchy or anything else like that. He's just, you know, I mean, authors of fiction authors are often critical of systems, basically, right? Like that's kind of one of the roles of fiction in society is to critique systems. And in here, he's critiquing systems of government authority. And in Bourne, he's critiquing systems of corporate authority. And that's.
Is he just critical of government authority, though? Because it feels like I'm just trying to find in my mind any alternative. Like, I think he's critical of bureaucracy or I don't want to say he's critical. There's bureaucracy is impotent against whatever Area X is. Like it and I think beneath that, even at a deeper layer, language is like the way in which we communicate understanding. And I think that like the government agencies show deep inhuman tendencies when they send people in with incomplete information or outright lie to them or hypnotize them. Like those are all terrible things, but I think that they're just sort of treated not like anything that is, you know, a message. It's just like this is just how it is. Like this is a human bureaucratic phenomena, and it's feckless against Area X. It just breaks down.
Although, I mean, ultimately, what isn't feckless against Area X, right? And one thing that I wondered, you know, and maybe there's not an answer to this, maybe this isn't something that contains a textual answer, but is the Southern Reach, like, so at the end of the novel, Area X escapes its confinement and begins seeping out into the world, right? And does Area X escape its confinement because the Southern Reach is hapless and incompetent, or has Area X somehow influenced the Southern Reach to be hapless and incompetent, right? And is the Southern Reach somehow maybe responsible for the escape, right? I mean, in some ways, like, it's being contained by whatever that force field is. Does Area X, by studying it, actually end up releasing it into the world where the containment field would have kept it? If not for their investigation, the containment field would have kept it, right? Are they not just incompetent, but by trying to exert authority over the thing, do they in fact cause its catastrophic release?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
That hadn't occurred to me.
I guess maybe it's partly hard to say because, like, I feel like I tried to pay pretty careful attention this time. And if you were to ask me, like, well, why does Area X burst out at this particular time? How does it beat the containment field right just about then? I don't really know, right? I mean, that is inexplicable within the world of the book, I think. Am I missing anything that...
Or has it been there the whole time? And because control, he's not first person. It's an interesting thing to compare between the first book and the second book, because the first book is first person told by the biologist. And even though we're in the it's mediated through the biologist's perspective directly, I feel as though, and even though, like, and the biologist is not seeing everything correctly for periods of the book, that book feels so lucid, and authority feels so Hall of Mirrors-y, you know, and I'm not quite sure, at least I can't say that, like, Area X, like just knowing that like Control is being manipulated, has blackouts, has been acting, you know, has been doing things without his own, you know, without being conscious of them. Are we sure that like that Area X has burst out at this moment, or
was that slippery rubber wall there the whole time and he just never was allowed to notice it because he was hypnotized?
Basically? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I
given how catastrophic it seems to be, right? Given the way that it seems to trigger given the way that it's talked about and the way that it's reacted to when it does burst out. I mean, I don't think that like I think there is a sudden change of state in the moment that's given to us as such. Although maybe if I were to go back and reread it, bearing that thought in mind, maybe I'd feel differently. But I definitely took it as being like a change in the objective reality of the book when there's the wall there where there should be the door. I guess I was thinking more like, has the, you know, Whitby's made the kind of diorama of monsters in the upstairs room, and the director has scrawled Saul Evans' words all over the inside of the closet, and there are hints that the director is you know, coming back to her own house and is, like, out in the world. There are other, you know, survivors who've been doppelgangered out into the world. I guess the best I can think of is that there's some way in which those psychic extrusions into the world, they reach a critical mass somehow that allows Area X to break out.
There has to be some kind of trigger, you're saying. And is it, does it have to do with the Southern Reach being incompetent? Does it have to do with a process that would have occurred anyway?
Right.
Yeah.
There has to be some kind of trigger. Would Area X have burst out right then, no matter what we did? Was that just completely inevitable? Or was that hastened somehow by people within the Southern Reach kind of having their minds polluted by contact with it in the ways that they are? I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's any textual evidence to say one way or the other. It kind of feels... it feels thematically more satisfying if Area X bursts out because it's being, you know, prodded by the Southern Reach, essentially. If Area X bursts out because they're making the efforts they are to understand and contain it incompetently as they do. But, you know, I don't know if there's anything in there that you could definitively use to say that.
Is the, like, this is kind of on the same topic, and I'm wondering if it's related. So I got the feeling that the director from the not Control, who's the director now, but the previous director, who is the psychologist from the first novel, and Whitby, like, they're both, it seems like one thing that Control discovers is that they have both slowly kind of gone insane, right? Now, the previous director, she has gone into the area, she went into the area in the first novel, and I'm trying to remember, is it revealed that she went in a few different times as well, or just that one time?
I think she went in once on her own, and then once as part of the 12th expedition. If I remember right.
Okay. But Whitby has never gone in, right?
That we know of.
That we know of.
At this point.
So I reacted to, like, the revelation of Whitby's madness and the director's that, like, despite the fact that Area X has not yet enveloped the Southern Reach facility, it has still had some type of influence on them. Hans, you said psychic extrusions, which is pretty fantastic terminology there. So it seemed to me that, like, the area was still affecting them, even though they hadn't gone into it. And so even if there wasn't necessarily a triggering incident that, you know, says, well, the door is going to turn into a rubbery wall at this point because of this trigger, it seemed at least that there was a hint that, like in the madness of Whitby and the director, that this was going to happen. Does that make sense, or am I just making stuff up, you think?
It really...
That makes sense to me,
I think that may be where, you know, when I think about Area X sort of expanding beyond its borders without anyone knowing, I think that comes from the kind of bizarre, almost superstitious methodology of the Southern Reach. The ideas about not having names, about the director's notes that I believe Control discovers in the drawer, or I think maybe layered underneath that plant that wouldn't die, about the biologist and about how Area X would respond to her in particular. And it just seems to me that, like, this understanding, this lack of understanding, this white noise that you get back from Area X seems to push these very brilliant or once brilliant people into very bizarre, like, intuitive leaps and even super, like, sort of pseudoscientific stances that don't, like, there's a number of conjectures in the first half or so of the novel that I don't really think are meant to really go anywhere about what the nature of Area X is. It's more a reflection of the fact that, like, it, without it giving back anything, like, it breaks them somehow. And that in and of itself seems to kind of advance what Area X is.
And I suppose is maybe a defense mechanism that it has, right? To keep itself from being studied or understood or, you know, suppressed, it kind of fights back by somehow sort of, maybe even just through, I'm trying to think, is there a mechanism for how it kind of corrupts the thinking of the people studying it? To some extent, it might just be like the images themselves, you know, the experience of seeing what the expeditions brought back, right? The videos the expeditions brought back, the journals, that there's some way in which just like that level of secondhand experience of it has a corrupting effect that drives them mad in ways which then keeps them from studying it in an effective way that would actually allow them to contain it or, you know, push it back. I thought about that a little bit in relationship to, there are a few things here that have kind of a quality of answering questions from the first novel in ways that maybe turn out to actually not shed much real understanding. In particular, you know, in the first novel, there's kind of this mystery of these words that the crawlers is inscribing in tunnels in living, glowing, I don't know what it is, fungi. And in the second novel, we discover that the lighthouse keeper, Saul Evans, was a preacher, right? And these are texts from his sermons. And so there's an effect there where, you know, you have the sense reading the first novel that maybe there's, that it's just inscrutable what these words mean or how, where they come from. And it's very, it kind of defies understanding. And then in some sense, you're given an answer in the second novel, but then the fact of having an answer actually kind of has it has like the shape of understanding, but it doesn't actually really tell you anything, you know? Deliberately so, I think, right? Like, and I just was, I don't know if I can shape this into a question, but that quality of providing almost answers which are not answers, right? Or like the first book setting up questions and then us discovering that actually the answers to them are not as relevant as we might expect them to have been. That, I don't know, was just an interesting device to me. Has a way of kind of mimicking the experience that the characters have of trying to investigate this place and actually not getting anything even when they think that they are.
It certainly makes sense that the words end up, you know, for an example of what you're talking about, Hans, it makes sense that the words that are written in the fungus in the first book end up being the words of the sermons of Saul Evans, because somehow Area X or some force or living thing within Area X has fused with Evans. So that kind of makes sense, right? That like somehow it's this new Evans / Area X being is recalling some of these things from Evans' previous life. But like the words themselves as sermons, like, are still pretty macabre and opaque, right? Like, they aren't your typical sermon. Like, assuming he was some type of Protestant preacher, you know, you would think that his sermons would be about, like, you know, they would recall the parables of Jesus, or they would, you know, analyze the teachings of Jeremiah or Isaiah or whatever, you know, some other big biblical figure. And yet, as far as I know, they don't. They are kind of a weird string of poetic sounding words, right? So, you know, that, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm not exactly making a point other than that it makes sense that these words would come from the crawler in book one, since the crawler is some mutated form of Evans who created the words, which we find out in book two. But the words themselves still have very little meaning for us. And, you know, why are the words like they are? Are they just aberrant kind of random pop-ups or whatever, or some word that you want to use of the area? You know, it's nebulous.
I guess, I mean, like, the other way to put it would be, like, if he was an accountant, would it have been spreadsheets, you know, or whatever, you know, that there were, it's, and so, like, the actual, I think this is said, you know, maybe in book one, I don't remember, but that... I think it is Sue. I think Sue might suggest that the meaning is meaningless, and the actual point is the thing that's being laid down on the is the material. I mean, like, if that's the case, then the sermon might not have ever meant anything. You know, it might have been kind of like just this side of what's it called, speaking in tongues, kind of poetic, airy nothingness. I don't know.
There's a lot about this book that is, or both of these books, that's, you know, can be categorized as, I don't know.
It's why it's really interesting that you dig it, because I, you know, not to pick on this, we pick on this a lot, but you tend to like stuff that really comes together and has a cohesive meaning, and this feels very prismatic.
Well, I only need one thing. Like, the fact that the novel is critical of authority is enough for me to be anchored. You know, I really only need, like, one sure thing to make me feel invested and to make me feel interested. And then I'm willing to, like, really, really get into it. You know, and unlike the other spy novel that we read, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, this novel does have that, like, definite thematic kind of concept or core, whereas, you know, when we talked about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, we kind of struggled. I think you, Chris, indicated that you thought that it was, like, critical of the spy apparatus, but I didn't see that as clearly, whereas we're in this novel, freaking authoritarian people are incompetent morons or corrupt. Yeah, I got it.
I think it balances really well in that regard, actually, right? Where it does have you can read a pretty clear kind of, you can read a pretty clear, I guess, political, cultural satire into it. And at the same time, it has areas of ambiguity as well. I mean, another thing that we've talked about a lot is the way that, certainly me, but I think all of us to some extent, really, like, I appreciate, and I think all of us to some extent appreciate, kind of going into something and coming out the other side with things that you got and understood and things that maybe are still in there to go back through for, right? And I think that this, it does a really good job of balancing both a kind of clear thematic agenda and areas of mystery that may or may not have any kind of internal resolution. Well, that seems like a really good part to end on. So thank you much, everybody, for listening to our discussion of Authority. Unless you had other things you wanted to say, either one of you.
No. Not that I know of.
Okay, cool. You just said okay in a way that suggested you were surprised. This is a shorter pod than we usually do, but...
Yeah, that was the only reason that I was like, oh, okay. I thought you would want to... you know, keep going for 10 or 15 more minutes, but, you know, yeah, agree that
we used up all my questions, so.
sure,
and it is, I mean, it's the middle of something, right? So we might have a longer pod next time, because we're thinking about both one book and the kind of wholeness of the
and
thing.
I don't know if you saw this, but he's writing a fourth.
Yeah, this is actually, that's part of what inspired me to pick this when I did, right? Is like, I think the fourth one's coming out in September, if I remember right.
How long ago did he write?
10 years. The third one's 10 years ago.
The third one was 10 years ago? Oh, man. I'm skeptical then.
Yeah.
I'm always skeptical when they...
Money grab. He's like, I'm going to go back to Area X, get that.
I don't know if it's a money grab. It's just, you know...
It's a prequel, apparently, for what that's worth.
Oh, yeah, that's even worse.
Yeah.
That's even worse.
I would be skeptical of it, except that, I did really enjoy Bourne, and I really enjoyed Strange Bird, which was a novella in the same universe. And I haven't read Dead Astronauts yet, but, you know, I will, and I probably will enjoy it. So, I mean, I don't know how I would feel about it. I'm not sure how I feel about it now. For a long time, like, I probably held Bourne in much higher regard than the Southern Reach trilogy. Having reread both of them now, having read them both twice, I'm not as sure I feel that way. But, I mean, he's someone that I think of as being still in prime shape, basically.
Right. Sure.
Would you, I was thinking, like Annihilation... I had just reread High Rise, and I don't think that like it's a one to one or at all a one to one, but I did think Ballardi, like kind of J.G. Ballard esque, maybe also because of the Drowned World. I also have relatively recently read that one, so that one has just sort of like. Go ahead, Hans.
This may sound too tidy, but I had actually thought about drawing a ballad comparison in when I was writing the questions up for Annihilation. But I just kind of felt like I wasn't sure that it would lead anywhere really other than kind of saying, these two things are alike, right? I wasn't sure it would lead anywhere that helped make meaning out of Annihilation. And I'd forgotten, honestly, that we had done High Rise on the pod. I wasn't sure how much background you guys would have in Ballard, but, you know, I mean, you have both read High Rise and probably Crash, I think, at least, Chris, you have. I don't know, Patrick, if you have.
I saw the great movie.
And the movie's actually pretty similar, right? I mean, it is. The movie's about as faithful an adaptation as I can imagine having been made, actually, to the point where a lot of the dialogue and voiceover is just, like, straight out of the book. It's one of the more faithful adaptations that I can think of, actually.
Yeah.
And the movie really. Yeah, I mean, Chris, maybe this is what you were going to say, Chris, but I think like the character arc of Annihilation is
super
classic
high-rise.
Ballard,
yeah.
Right? Like the thing about High Rise is like that character arc, right, where you have a protagonist who comes from a place of normalcy, enters a world or an activity or a subculture or a place that should be frightening and off-putting and scary, is initially frightened and off-put by it, eventually discovers that it has awakened something within himself or herself. Mm. In Ballard, it's always a him. And then embraces it full-throatedly, runs into it, into what is almost certainly self-destruction at the end. Like that arc... I mean, Ballard wrote, what, like 25, 30 novels, and almost every one of them follows that exact arc, right? It's so much so that it becomes kind of comical if you read them all in a year or two. so, as I did in my younger, dumber days, before I figured out that, like, reading every novel by somebody in a very very condensed space is almost always going to give you diminishing returns. But, yeah.
Yeah, what's up, buddy? Tech block killing your girlfriends?
Yes.
All right, hold on. I think that's the signal that it's over.
All right. Well, thank you much, everybody, for listening to our episode on Authority. Chris, I'm sorry that I completely hijacked the point you were going to make about the Ballardian nature of Annihilation and took credit for it and didn't give you any chance to make the point you had introduced. And yeah, we'll see everybody in a couple weeks for Authority. Or not Authority. This was Authority. Acceptance is the last book, which we're doing.
Yeah, and I think that we'll come back to that, actually, that topic. So thanks, Hans.
Come back to the Ballardian.
Yeah, the Ballardian thing.
Okay. All right. Bye, everyone.